Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
International is a non-profit, non-partisan organization working towards informed, citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
This is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. You are listening live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Hunkamina-speaking Musqueam people. My name is Josh. This is the last episode of Textbook probably ever. So it's going to be great. It's going to be a great show. It's a dull, overcast day. And it's just very, very Vancouver day out here. We have a couple interviews, and I'm also going to try something new. I'm just going to go ahead and tell a story because I have not told any stories this year on the show. I've had people come by and tell stories, and I've had clubs come by to talk about what they do here on campus, and I've had people come by and talk about their papers. But today, we have AMS Refugee Relief, UBC. It's a club here supporting refugees and newcomers to Canada. And we have an interview with some students from Sonic Geographies, which is a class here at UBC that deals with space and sound. Should be really interesting. We're also going to play a piece from them about The Nest. But first, a song from Watermelon. This is Golden Ray Migration off of their cassette from 2013. Here it is. Thanks so much for listening.
Thank you.
Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. That's Golden Ray Migration by Watermelon. That features Tom Lougheed, who was, if you remember from 2 weeks back, the Joe Fortes audio diary. He was a part of that. And from McKinney, who is interviewed today on the show. We'll play that interview later. It's with some folks that did a Sonic Geographies project here at the Nest. First up, it's an interview with the AMS Refugee Relief UBC from in-studio session earlier today. Thanks so much for listening. Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. AMS Refugee Relief at UBC was started 2 years ago by Lily Wentworth, Joy Smallenberg, and some other students here at UBC. Lily and Joy are in the studio with me right now. Lily is treasurer, Joy is president external. So I was wondering if you guys could just start off, what did it look like when you guys were getting the club started?
So the club started in October of 2015, and the two of us had some conversations about what we were seeing in the media, what was going on, and just feeling really emotionally burdened, I think, to some extent, by what we were seeing. And we met our friend Katrina at a lecture on campus, and she was really passionate about private sponsorship. So we came together. There's five of us students, and we decided, let's do something. So it was really just started with conversation. We held a meeting. We had about 50 people at our first meeting. We met up with community members, with professors. There's a church in the community, and it really all started from there.
And we put posters up around campus just to get people involved, and at our first meeting, we actually were really surprised by how many people showed up. We had around 50 students who were all really interested in getting involved in the cause.
I think something really important to note is it seems really daunting, like how do you actually do something and make it happen, but it really just came about from about a week of intentional conversation and just desire to do something.
So this was back in 2015. Around in October, so the first semester of 2015. And since then, you've also thrown a lot of events. Can you tell me about some of the events that you put on?
Yeah, so we had our Sounds for Syria event 2 years ago, and it went really well. It's a coffee house event. We got different students to come and showcase their talent. So we had a magic show, we had spoken word, musical performances, dancers. And because it went so well, we decided to hold it again this year, and it was very successful again, and so we're hoping that in future years we'll also be able to continue holding a similar event.
Mm-hmm. I think something really interesting too was the domino effect. So even from that event, there was a student group at Marine Drive who were there and said, this is awesome, we want to do this. So a third event came out of that we didn't plan, and that's been our vision from day one, is to empower other leaders and give them a platform to do something.
We also had our cultural events week during our first year as a club or as a group. And during that week, we had a belly dancing class, an Arabic language class, and
Just a few other events just to raise awareness on campus. And that transitioned into our gala in the spring, which was really, really successful. We had over 100 people attend a silent auction that raised over $1,000 in of itself in addition to tickets. And we were able to repeat that event again this year.
So what are your you talked before about before the interview started about kind of tangible results and seeing making tangible difference. What does it look like to privately sponsor refugees coming to Canada? What how much money are you guys hoping to raise, and what is that? What are the results of that?
Mm-hmm. So last year we did that along with a private sponsorship or agreement holder, which was St. Helens Anglican Church, as well as some really committed Vancouver citizens who are already involved in the process. So when we started the conversations in the fall, we calculated that at least $72,000 would be needed for this family of eight, which is now 10 because there's two babies, really exciting, to come to Canada. So that goal was exceeded quite significantly. But again, rent in of itself, we calculated would be around $36,000 for the family for a year. So the numbers are high. And this year we are repeating the process again, but as students independently. And so $40,000 is our goal, which is lower because there's four refugees instead of 10. But again, we have to identify some sort of private sponsorship agreement holder for it to be possible.
And in order to sponsor them, we have to be able to raise enough money to support them for 1 year, after which they're expected to be able to be self-sufficient. So we're hoping that these folks that we're sponsoring this year, being English speakers already, that their transition into Canadian life will be easier, and getting jobs will be a lot more easy to come by.
Mm-hmm. So the idea here is that you need as you guys are doing private sponsoring, and then you kind of have like an institutional link. Mm-hmm. And what are the benefits? Why would you get an institutional link?
Mm-hmm.
So the government has three different refugee streams of the Canadian government for intake, and the kind of policy and the requirements behind each one is fluctuating. So we saw a drastic fluctuation from the transition from the Conservative government to the Liberal government. But now even within the Liberal government, after the 25,000, the target was met, now there's more restrictions that are being put into place because there's such a high backlog, and there's refugees from tons of other countries as well. And so we identified that for the purpose of helping the four young adults from Syria get here as soon as possible, that this would make the most sense. And the reason we do need the private sponsorship agreement holder is when we're submitting the paperwork, it's much more likely that a group like a community center or church would be trusted with that sum of money than students. But again, so we have to approach the churches, approach the community centers and say, we've raised this much. Are you willing to partner with us? So that's one of our challenges right now.
And we're hoping that if we come to them with a certain amount of money already raised, whether it's the $20,000 that we've already raised or an additional $20,000, that they'd be more likely to help us out as well, since that burden will not be on them.
So you folks have kind of created this platform to get involved at UBC. You have these events and you're raising money. What are the other kind of ways that you're getting engaged with this? You mentioned some door-to-door work.
Yeah, so earlier this year we went door-to-door in Point Grey, just knocking on people's doors and asking them if they'd like to donate to our cause, and we received a lot of positive responses. So many people were very interested in getting involved. They were very happy that it was UBC students who were getting involved in this. We did encounter some interesting things. So for instance, we had some photos that we were showing of the four members that we are sponsoring this year. And one person said, oh, well, they look too happy. You should be showing them, like, you know, down and you know, like as refugees. And we said, well, no, we don't want to show them this way. We don't want to exploit them because they're human beings. They're not just refugees. And so that's one of the difficult things that we've encountered and something that we need to be aware of as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting, Lily, what you just said, as refugees. Like, what does our culture think of when we talk about that? And imagine if something were to happen in Canada, in North America, and everyone here, regardless of your social status, your career, whatever you're working on, would all of a sudden be a refugee. So I think it's really important to kind of zoom out and think about the external factors that are really causing great, great trial in our world, and that they can affect the lives of anyone and everyone.
Have you hit any kind of other challenges or difficulties in terms of getting people involved?
So two things come to mind. The first thing is we have absolutely noticed fluctuations in involvement kind of paralleling the media representation. So two falls ago in 2015, the influx was great. A lot of people were interested. But at that point, again, there was a lot of media attention. And then when we went further through the year, we did notice that as the media stopped showing it, people are less interested to follow through. So that's one thing. And I know another thing. So for myself as a self-identified Christian, it's been very interesting kind of within that community, seeing the different responses. So to one extent, some people are thrilled and saying that we should love our neighbors as ourselves, and this is great. And on another extent, there's people who are really, really upset about it and who do not want to be involved in this. And so I think responding to that intentionally, and it's quite frustrating sometimes to kind of be in those conversations. But I think that again shows that there's so many pieces to this. There's awareness pieces, there's information pieces, fact pieces. Empathy is a huge thing. I'm doing some research right now that's showing that empathy is one of the most significant predictors of whether a Canadian is willing to accept refugees. So that's interesting as well.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about like kind of the academic base you folks are coming on. You mentioned you're both sociology and French students. You're both graduating this year. What has it been like kind of over the last 2 years since the group has started studying, and how have kind of your academic interests, your scholarly interests, and this club really, where have the intersections been?
So I know for myself, I definitely found that, okay, so two things. So first of all, I found it more difficult to focus to some extent on some classes, having the weight of this and the understanding of what's going on in the world being on my shoulders. So I intentionally modified my curriculum to include some self-directed studies this year to talk about refugee policy in Canada and diplomacy and government. And I'm very interested in pursuing those programs at Oxford. I was a Rhodes Scholarship finalist last year. And if funding were to come, like, I would love to go to Oxford. I would love to work on policy because there's huge institutional issues behind this whole thing. So we're doing everything we can as students, but at the end of the day, there are kind of higher kind of levels that are controlling what's going on, and I'd like to influence that if I could.
Definitely being a sociology student has helped helped me just be more aware of the societal issues that are going on and the different relationships between people. And I think that that's helped me with the refugee crisis and just having, as Jory said, having empathy for people. And I've definitely also used the experiences of sponsoring these refugees and now newcomers to Canada in my studies as well. So writing papers, I try to integrate how the process is going and things like that. So I think that that's also been mm-hmm. a way that that's helped in my studies, and that's a way that it's linked.
You mentioned before that you'd recently had a storytelling event, which is very much, you know, kind of the other, if you're thinking academic, is quite, you know, research and one kind of way of, I guess, engaging with this issue. There's the storytelling event that you guys had, and hearing the stories, that I think that may be another one. So do you want to tell me a little bit about that event and what it was like?
So earlier this year we had a speaking event in the Global Lounge. It was called Traveled Stories, a Dialogue with Refugees and Their Allies. And it was an event where we had three different speakers come who were all directly impacted by refugee crises around the world. And so I think that that was a great way to get people and students involved. And it was an interesting way to hear some anecdotal stories from people about their own personal experiences with being refugees or having mm-hmm. family members who are refugees.
Mm-hmm. So to kind of picture this event or imagine it, we were actually all sitting on the floor in a circle and just crisscross applesauce and just really talking story. And I think that that's really important. That's something so universal. And one of our guests was Tima Curdy. So her two nephews and her brother's wife were killed in the refugee crisis as they were traveling in the sea, and the dinghy collapsed. And I remember hearing that on the news, the story, and just hearing the husband cry out and say that his wife looked like a floating kind of balloon beside him, and his boys were screaming out, "Please help me, daddy," and just the emotion of that. And it's difficult to talk about it and to process that. And I think there's so much distance between our very privileged society and what's really going on. And so she came, and it was an absolute honor to meet her. And she was so engaged with the students and saying, if you want to come alongside me and work with my organization, please do. If you want to come travel with me, please do. And so just making that connection and just seeing her face to face, that was really impactful to me.
What's been the most interesting thing that you've learned about kind of this documentation process for new arrivals coming to Canada?
It is very difficult. Last year, one of our members is an Arabic speaker, and she sat with the dedicated Vancouver citizens that were involved with the first family and translated a stack of papers that's higher of any stack of papers that I've ever seen. So I think there are so many institutional kind of barriers, and maybe some necessary, some not, but to kind of navigate this whole process. And it's so difficult. Like, as a refugee, you can't just leave your country. There's different options. You can become a UNHCR refugee, but then the paperwork for that is quite substantial. And so it's really a lot of back and forth, Skype conversations, having to provide background information going way back. And there's so many sections, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And so it's really kind of navigating that, unless you have a really dedicated person on the other end, a family member or community member willing to do that, it's almost impossible.
You mentioned, like last year, successfully, you brought this family of now 10 over to Canada. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about what it's been like hanging out with them and since they've been in Canada?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So it's been great. I remember we went, so one of the refugees is 21 years old, so he's our age, and we went with him to Granville Island and just looked around at the sights and sounds, and we were just sitting out there on the pier, and it was dark and the stars were out, and he was telling us what he liked about Vancouver, and that it was a quiet city and it was a peaceful city, and he was teaching us Arabic and we were trying to learn, and just kind of that face-to-face interaction was very powerful. And it is a Muslim family, and so one thing that was really important in kind of settling the family here was their mosque close to where their home was. So, for example, do you want to live by UBC? Do you want to live by a mosque? Do you want to live downtown? So kind of those more practical details were really important. And then it's always been important to us that our group is inclusive and diverse, and I think that's our strength. We have very active members, both from University Christian Ministries and the Muslim Student Association, and members who do not adhere to a faith background. So that the point isn't faith. The point is that this is a human issue. This is an empathy issue, and everyone can get involved.
I think it's been really neat getting to meet the family as well. So I was there, they came in stages, and I was there for three of the different groups of people at the airport, and meeting them was really, really nice. It was very emotional. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards going and seeing them, we went to a basketball game, we took them bowling, and so all of that is a really good way to get involved and learn more about the Muslim community as well as getting them integrated in the Canadian community.
Great. Jory and Lily, thank you so much for coming and speaking on the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. That was an interview with the UBC AMS Refugee Relief Club. We'll be back with another interview after these short messages. Thanks for listening.
Salam. Ruzetun bekhair. My name is Sahan, the president of UBC Persian Club.
And this is Yasaman, the VP admin.
UBC Persian Club is a non-profit student organization with the goal of empowering the Iranian community at UBC by acting as a social hub for Iranian students, bringing together diverse members of the community who have a common interest in Iranian culture, and nurturing and representing the Iranian community in Vancouver.
We have monthly member-exclusive events, Pelon, we screen documentary movies and short films by Iranian directors with English subtitles. Music Gatherings, a series of casual music gatherings at which students can play different types of instruments, and sports events and game nights.
Our regular events are member exclusive and you will receive 25% discount on our annual events. You can visit us at ubcpc.com or email us through info@ubcpc.com.
Or you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
Out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Josh. This is the final episode of Textbook. And let me tell you, it's been a real pleasure being in the nest here at UBC. It is a very weird space. Very, very weird space. And actually, it's pretty, you know, it's cozy. It's cozy sometimes. It's really miserable other times. It's a bit like a mall, sometimes we have to compete with the Thunderbird Marching Band and all sorts of different groups here trying to vie for space and vie for the sound of the space. So this is an interview I had a lot of fun doing because the nest is just, yeah, like I said, it's a very, very weird place to be, very weird place to hang out. CITR, of course, is in the ground floor of the nest. And so we're right on in the Agora, which is kind of the main area at the nest where a lot of stuff happens and where they kind of dump a lot of events. So this is an interview with two members of UBC Sonic Geography's class, two students enrolled in the class, who did a project about nest and the sounds, specifically the sounds in the nest. So this is from earlier today. I'm going to play this interview first. They talk a little bit about the piece. They talk about what they did, collecting field recordings and such, and then I'm going to go straight into the actual piece, which is, yeah, a compilation of recordings from inside the nest that get a kind of a sense of the power dynamics at play and the sound of the space. So here it is, an interview from earlier today. Thanks for listening. Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. Do you want to start by just introducing yourselves?
So my name is Nick Penner, a major in human geography here at UBC.
Hi, my name is Akane Yamaki, and I'm also a major in human geography at UBC.
So tell me a little bit about the project that you guys did in this space, in the nest.
So what we did is we're in a research strategies course, and we narrowed in on the sonic geography subject, which is essentially studying the soundscape of a space. So like you're kind of analyzing the characteristics in terms of like the auditory dimension of the space. So what we did is we chose the Nest as our sort of venue, and we basically began recording the space, all different sorts of sounds that have been made in here, and compiled them into an audio drift, which is essentially just a compilation of recorded sounds that are supposed to reflect our particular place. So, yeah, and we were thinking about a whole bunch of different things within that. Yeah, I don't know if Connie, you want to speak to those themes that we had?
Yeah, so basically I think a lot of the themes that we were sort of looking at were based around power and how structures of power could maybe be heard sonically in the space. So I think that that was like definitely one of our major themes, and then also sort of like looking at ideas of consumption in the space and like looking, considering like how this space is an agora, or like it's sort of purported to be an agora, and whether or not it actually functions in that way that's like sort of equal and accessible to everybody. And so we sort of examined that through sound, again, geographically, I guess.
Tell me a little bit about what this space is. Describe it and maybe give it a little bit of context for listeners.
So it's basically, the main floor is big and open. There's steps. there's like steps that people can sit on. It's kind of agora-like. I think people describe it that way. There's a large looming egg thing in the middle. It's an open space. I think, you know, it's very public. You're very visible. I think it's very performative because of that. And so I think, yeah, that's... Mm-hmm.
And what about the kind of sonic features of the architecture?
So, what we found is, since there's such a wide variety of activities, we have lots of stores, we have lots of spaces for social activity and studying as well. So it's a very diverse space, and as a result, we have a lot of, like, a wide variety of sounds, a lot of chatter, a lot of different types of music. So we have music from live shows, we have music from the stores, which is sort of like it's like top 40, very stimulating music that stores use strategically to promote consumption. And then we have sort of radio, which is very more experimental music sounds. On top of that, we just have sort of sounds of studying, and those actually seem to occur on the second and third, fourth floors. So the main floor is where a lot of the more music and chatter is occurring, and then as you go higher, it gets quieter and more around a studying orientation.
Yeah.
What was the process like for recording?
So there was how many of us? There was six of us.
Yeah.
And so we each came in here for a 2-week period, and we came in about two times a day. So and we did that for 2 weeks, and we sort of just, for myself, I just sort of like walked around and tried to record like what I found, like thought was interesting, and sort of like try to capture the like entire space as best I could. I don't know.
What kind of tensions were you trying to identify or maybe like play out in the space?
So what we kind of found right off the bat was there is a pretty major clash between sounds of consumption from the stores and sort of sounds of studying / social activity. So that kind of played out with, for instance, what I was talking about before with the different types of music. So we have the music from the stores, which was kind of like, you can be described as Muzak, which is very stimulating, very poppy, loud music that kind of stimulates the buyer. And then we've noticed that that's been very dominant in the space, as opposed to sort of sounds coming from the radio, which they only have one speaker.
It's used in the same way that you would see it used in like a mall or a place that is specifically for consumption, I think, which I thought was interesting.
That also played out with, I was talking before about the placement of vending machines. Those have been very prominently placed in the space, and when you are on the second and third floors, they actually dominate the soundscape with the humming that they create, and I think that also promotes this consumption sound. Space.
Give me a bit of a sense of the theoretical background that you're coming from for this project. This is a sonic geographies course. Sorry, it was a human geography course. What are some of the ideas? Who are some of the theorists to look at for this stuff?
Michael Gallagher, I think. He's like one of the major, we were reading him definitely when we were doing our audio drift, because that was sort of like a really great guide to like how to put it together. And I think the PhD student that we worked with, Max Ritz, is obviously like, he's, you know, this is like his topic, and he's very like well informed. He'd be a good person to look up.
He has a UBC blog. It's called Sonic Geographies. Mm-hmm. So we're working off of that as well.
And all of our information is actually on there, I think. Mm-hmm. Our whole project, I think, is on there.
And what about you two personally? What kind of backgrounds are you coming from in terms of research interests and academic backgrounds?
So I'm moving into a Master's of Architecture next year. So that's my background. I'm also really into like music as well. So I'm really interested in the architectural acoustics of design. And so this is a great project for both of those things.
Yeah, I just sort of found it to be really interesting to like sort of take this intangible thing and consider it very materially and spatially, which I think is important because it's sort of a dimension that we really don't consider very often. So I thought that was very interesting. And also, I'm a musician, so I'm just sort of interested in how sound works in general.
What were some of the most interesting recordings that you found over the course of this, or maybe experiences that you had while recording that, that really stood out to you?
Mm. Yeah, so, I mean, it's the actual recording of it is maybe not the most interesting part because you kind of get what you expect from the space when you're just recording sounds. Mm-hmm. It was a lot more interesting when we were compiling them together, and it was a lot more interesting to hear from the architects from their perspective when we were interviewing those people. Mm-hmm. Just hearing kind of the backstory about why certain things were placed in certain places and how that may influence the soundscape. So, yeah, it was just a matter of kind of hearing those different perspectives and, sort of those.
I mean, yeah, I think the recording itself wasn't... I mean, I definitely probably went to parts of the building that I haven't otherwise used because it's sort of like a space that I wasn't as familiar with. But, I mean, I was surprised how much people don't notice what you're doing at mm-hmm. all. Like, you
care.
Can just stand next to them with a recorder and they don't care or, like, notice that you exist at all. It's
right.
impressive.
Yeah, that's true.
What was it like talking to the architects that actually designed the space?
I can't speak to that because I didn't do any of that.
Yeah,
but.
Actually, no, that was I did both of those. So it was very interesting. So what we got from the one architect, he's the principal architect from B+H, which is the main firm, I guess, that was involved in this project. It was very enlightening to hear that there was a very deep interest in architectural acoustics in this building. Simply because of like the wide variety of activities, which is far greater than a usual building. So they really took into account the sound of this building. And as a result, they have implemented countless insulation ways. So like these are through the railings. The fans themselves are actually suspended by springs to reduce vibrations in the ceilings. There's perforated walls in the hallways and wooden paneling to also absorb sound waves. So it's really impressive, actually, how much they were really thinking about sound in this building.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So it's actually kind of like in the space, like the actual mm-hmm. materials mm-hmm. and everything of this space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is, I mean, I think it's definitely not the first thing that you think about when you think about the architecture of a space, but it's actually so important. Because it really changes how people interact with the space. Because if it's overly loud or it's overly quiet, people feel uncomfortable and you can't be in that space and it's not as useful.
And that's what the architects highlighted. So they were saying it's something that people don't generally think about. And as a result, the topic is kind of esoteric, is what they described it as. It's like acoustics was one area where the architects kind of take total control of that aspect of the design because people just don't know what to think about that. And so as a result, we have another power dynamic there. So the architects are really in control of the soundscapes, in a way, of this building.
The mall comparison is really interesting, too. Mm-hmm. And thinking about this space as a mall or, like, not as a mall, what did you kind of take away from this project on that question?
That's kind of a hard question, actually. I don't know. I think that, like, how I felt about it originally still sort of applies, in which I do feel like... It's definitely a space, like, promoted for, like, student consumption, which isn't necessarily, like, positive or negative because we all have, like, things that we need to buy and it's, you know, it's, a, like, a central location. But I do find that I think maybe it's not necessarily, like, strictly for students. And I think there's, like, a lot of different things at play in this building that maybe, like, I don't know, it's sort of hard to understand the motivations of, I guess.
Mm-hmm. When we're talking power dynamics in a space... For some listeners, that might not like seem immediately obvious. So, what are we thinking about when we're talking about the way that like is sound just an index of power in the space, or is it like a manifestation of power in the space? How does it work? What's the idea behind that?
So we were thinking about sort of sounds that were dominant in the soundscape. Because with sound, it's an interesting dimension of a space. So like when sound is made, you can't turn it off. Like when you can't turn your ears off. Like you can close your eyes, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's impossible to evade a sound being made when you're sharing a space. So that's very politically interesting. Mm-hmm. So you actually do have a lot of power when you're making sound in a space. In addition to that, we found it really interesting. We were talking to the project manager of this building, who has noted that there's actually no real noise regulations in this building. And they kind of rely on the fact that people just are considerate towards others with making sound. Mm-hmm. And so we're just in this constant kind of agreement that we're sharing a space and that you'll be considerate enough to act accordingly.
Which is, like, again, quite interesting, because I think it sort of enacts, like, this idea that we all have this sort of, like, shared understanding of how, like, space and sound should work. Because there's no regulations, that means that we have to implicitly understand that that's how the space needs to work. And it's interesting, like, that there's no written down rules about it, because I'm not sure that everyone actually has the same ideas about that, especially in, like, a place like a university where, you know, there's all different age levels, people from different countries. Like, I'm not, yeah, that's what was one question that I think we had left after finishing the project that I thought was interesting.
There's definitely a weird, like, classed thing to sound as well. Like, you think of, like, certain, like, fancy, like, upper-class places are, like, very quiet, and that's mm-hmm. something that's kind of, like, mm-hmm. accepted.
I think that's something that we also found in our research, is that people think that you can buy silence, and that's a big, like, that sounds way more harsh than what I mean. But, like, I think, yeah, like, expensive neighborhoods are quiet, and that's, like, regulated that way, and people, because, you know, you can pay somebody to make sure that there's no people yelling in the streets, right? Mm-hmm.
So what one thing we're trying to focus on mainly is a lot of, like, what sound studies may instantly go towards is just studying noise level, mm-hmm. sort of like just volume. But what we're actually thinking about is the characteristics of each sound being made and, like, what that entails socially for the space. Mm-hmm. So when we're making our audio drift, what we're reflecting in this recording is we're trying to make it sound like you're walking through the different parts of this building, starting at the main floor, moving up to the fourth. Just volume. Mm-hmm. So when we're making our audio drift, what we're reflecting in this recording is we're trying to make it sound like you're walking through the different parts of this building, starting at the main floor, moving up to the fourth floor. And as you move through, you're hearing the different activities that are taking place. And as you listen to it, you should think about, like, what those sounds, specific sounds, make you think, how those sounds might actually influence your behavior. And just, yeah, again, so the different levels in relation to each other, what kind of political connotations that could have, mm-hmm. essentially.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate awesome. You
thank
coming
you.
Down and talking to me.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure, thanks.
Three on the three. Three. Go. First floor. second floor. Third floor.
Place, but if you're like at the top of the nest, you can like see everyone doing like walking around.
Fourth floor.
There you have it, Sounds of the Nest, broadcast from Inside the Nest, a audio project from students of Sonic Geography class here at UBC. We'll be back with a story and some more music after these quick PSAs. Thanks for listening. Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM.
What if this summer you did something different? What if you worked with people you admired, in a city that inspired you, making something that you were proud of? The Media Institute for Social Change is looking for students like you to be a part of their summer documentary program in Portland, Oregon. As a student, you'll create original audio and video pieces about issues that you care about. You'll meet and learn from media professionals whose work is aimed at social justice. You'll immerse yourself in Portland, a city that will serve as your hands-on media-making laboratory. Sound like your type of summer? Apply today at mediamakingchange.org.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio. Let's see here,
Got
God. Ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down. Climbed up.
Ugh. Isn't there anything, 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 anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Everybody. We're back, textbook. Up next is the demo from the band Necking, local band here in Vancouver. Very good stuff. They'll be playing some shows this summer, so keep an eye out for them. Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. It's the final show ever. Here is Necking.
You
Hey, this is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM. We are winding down here on Textbook, the final episode ever. I just want to thank everybody that's been on the show this year, everybody that's come by and, rushed off from class or, come to campus when they don't need to tell a story or talk about some paper. And thanks also to all the clubs that came on the program this year. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate people. Some people, a lot of people coming on the radio for the first time, which can be really stressful. It can make your palm sweat. It can make you shake. It can make you just have word salad. So it's always good to have students on the air. And I really want to thank everybody for that. I also wanted to close off. I have 2 minutes here, not even 2 minutes. But I did want to close off with a story. Because I haven't told any stories at all. That part of the plan when I first started this show was to tell some stories, and I haven't really gotten a chance to. So I will tell one, mostly just because it's a story about animals, and animal stories did not get the justice they deserved on this show. Animal stories are just classic tales that are silly, and everybody can appreciate them. And I think we need more animal stories. We just need more animal stories here. So this one is a moose story, and it takes place 3 years ago. It was around this time in early May that I shipped off to go tree planting in northern BC, mostly near Smithers, up near Prince George, up quite north. And there are a lot of meese up there. And one day while I was planting, I'm not very good at planting, I'll be honest. I did it for 2 years, and both years I was just pretty bad at it, just did not have the motivation to go. You're sticking a shovel in the ground over and over again all day long. And by my second year, I was just super, super unhappy being there, and I took resources to try to make myself plant faster as much as I could. I took caffeine pills. I would drink a lot of coffee. I'd bring some in to the block with me and just really try to make the day go better. You have food on the block, which is great, and that's kind of the brief break that you get when you get to have some food. But most of the time you're just trying to plant as much as you can, because it's you're getting paid per tree. So on this day it was really hot out, and we were planting on this beautiful kind of drive-in, so it was pretty easy job. You just drive the truck in, you drop people off, drop trees off, and you plant. And it was on a hill on a pretty steep incline with a really beautiful view of the mountains. But it was not something that I particularly cared about, because it really was so brutal, and I was so bad at it, and I was still making so much money. So you just spend the day really thinking about how much money you're going to make, and just hating the job. So I was planting. I was planting on the upper side of the road, and on the lower side of the road was my friend Anne, and she was planting with her dog Lucy, which is really great black lab, like really energetic black lab. And I was planting, I was listening to music, just blaring it, throwing my shovel in the ground over and over again, opening up these holes, sticking a tree in, throwing my shovel in again, opening up these holes, sticking a tree in. And I found myself listening to music, wearing a coat. It's like weirdly cold, but like the sun is out, and the ground starts shaking. And I'm surrounded by stumps, and, everything's shaking. It's really odd. There's really no reason. So I pop my head up. I look up, and I see a moose running towards me, just full speed. And moose in person, in the flesh, like, they're so not storybook moose. They are, like, dirty, and they're full of fleas, and they have patches of hair missing and stuff. Like, they live a rough time, and they're really, really, like, kind of gross, big animals, like, huge animal running towards me, and it is tripping over all of these stumps, because it's, like, a big swath of land that's been cut down, all the trees have been cut down, so it's just tripping over these stumps as it runs with full force towards me, and I have no idea what to do. I look up this, and I've spent my whole day planting. I'm tired. I'm not having it. I'm on a bunch of these cheap caffeine pills from the pharmacy, and I froze up, and then I started just running away, which was stupid because the moose was running way faster than I was, and it was just charging at me. And I looked, I did not know what to do. and the moose is coming, and it's like these limbs are just flailing, like just tripping over itself. He starts running towards me, and then he, at the last minute, just pops up, runs into the tree line, and gets out of there. And I mean, the thing to do apparently in this situation is to use your